Welcome to another edition of The Nature of Longevity. I'm your host, Douglas Mulhall, and today I'm speaking with the discoverer of something that could stop hardening of the arteries that affects all of us as we age.
Imagine a Russian-born and educated woman scientist deciding to leave her homeland for good, coming to Harvard University, marrying a Japanese cardiologist, and together convincing the university to enter a unique partnership with one of Japan's largest companies to build a world-class laboratory, resulting in the discovery of a treatment that could prevent hardening of the arteries.
That's precisely what happened with the wife and husband team of Elena and Masanori Aikawa. Elena Aikawa is Naoki Miwa Distinguished Chair in Cardiovascular Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital and Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. It started in the early 1990s when Dr. Aikawa visited the U.S. from Moscow's leading university and decided not to go back. Shortly after that, she began exploring one of the great mysteries in medicine, why our arteries turn to stone. What followed was a discovery that pinpointed some of the key proteins that trigger the calcification process. Remarkably, her team also discovered that an off-the-shelf antiparasitic drug can reduce or even stop the process. It's a discovery that could transform cardiovascular medicine. I first met Elena Aikawa in 2007 when our team was filming a television documentary about the causes of hardening of the arteries. At that time, she was hot on the trail of what is known as microcalcification, the tiny particles that make up larger calcifications that eventually show up on scans of your arteries. But before we dive into the science, let's listen to how all of this happened, starting with a conversation in Tokyo that led to what was then a groundbreaking cooperation between a Japanese company and Harvard University. So you have this wonderful laboratory overlooking Harvard University, and it's really state of the art in every respect. How did all of that happen that you were able to develop these tremendous facilities at Harvard?
Yeah, that was also a very difficult process. It's very interesting because it's also related to my husband, who is actually directing this laboratory now. My husband is a Japanese scientist. He's a former cardiologist from Juntendo in Japan, who visited Tokyo once. And one of his former mentor, Dr. Kadama, came to him and introduced him to CEO of this company who I'm working with now. This CEO was CEO of the company, so-called KOWA, K-O-W-A, and he was very interested to expand his company to US. He was talking to Dr. Masanori Aikawa, and they decided they can try and approach leadership at the Brigham and Women's Hospital if this at all would be possible, because the previous academia-industry relationship was not really appreciated, let's put it that way. And it took maybe 3 years to convince Brigham and Women's Hospital leadership to finally have agreement between academia, you know, Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School as one entity, and KOWA pharmaceutical company from Japan as another entity, and make this lab, which would be focusing on target discovery for inflammation and cardiovascular calcification. And I think it really needed to have knowledge and talent of my husband, Dr. Masanori Aikawa, who knew the culture of the Japanese people, and being in academia for over 20 years, to know both sides very well to make it work. I think if it's someone who doesn't know Japanese culture, even in the initial steps, it would be very difficult to make any connection, because culturally, on very different levels, it's not so easy. So, but, you know, it happened and it works very well.
So you have, both of you really have succeeded, and you yourself graduated from one of the great Moscow universities. So this is really an incredible combination, right? Russian, Japanese, American, And you're really talking about two types of culture here that you've managed to overcome, and maybe even three. The first type is the Japanese versus the American culture, but the second one, and probably the key, is that you've overcome the academic versus the corporate culture that has so often been a barrier to translation of drug discovery, which is why it takes so long. So, you know, congratulations for that.
Exactly. Yeah, in our case, you know, this again, it's very unique because scientists from COWA coming to our lab, which is in Harvard and Brigham, and work with us in the same working space, you know, in the same research lab next to each other. And then when they come to the lab, they often don't know English very well, but within a year, within 3-5 years, depending on the situation, but they could stay with us for 5 years. They're coming back as a mature scientist with the ability to discuss in English, write in English. Almost all of them have academic papers published within the lab before they return to Tokyo. And they come back to their company with the global view and the ability to discuss on different level with the other companies who are speaking in English. You know what I mean? And they have this different quality, totally mature, different people when they come in 5 years before or something like that. So it's very interesting. So now we often have meetings between our lab and Tokyo a few times a month. Now we need to do it very late in the night, but you know, we have to communicate with them. And now our trainees, which were trained in our lab, let's say 5-10 years ago, sitting on the other side of the screen and talking with us as the leaders of COWA in perfect English. So this is how we communicate now. It's very different. This 12 years was an incredible journey.
Well, congratulations to you. It must be very rewarding to see all of that coming to fruition. And, you know, for the ordinary person, most people think, especially these days with, oh, big pharma, that it's all some process where the company comes along and does it all. But actually, it is this combination of work between a company and academia. And actually, that has been one of the huge problems with translating academic work into pharmacological work that drug companies can actually deal with. And that's why it has taken maybe anywhere from 10 to 15 years to get to market. So the significance of your work is that you're putting those worlds together, but you're putting one more very important world together. I want to talk about this for a moment. This field of calcification and elastic repair and even heart disease has traditionally been dominated by men. And you have broken that mold. You've broken through that glass ceiling. Tell me a bit about that.
I was not alone to break the ceiling. You know, all calcification field and extracellular vesicle field has more women than men. Indeed, you know, we have so many very prominent investigators in calcification field, including Kathy Shanahan, who is also another investigator who is working on calcifying extracellular vesicles. I think it makes us two, one in Europe, one in the US. And we also have Linda Dimmer and Cici Giacelli and some others who are really moving the field and made lots of discoveries in calcification. Yeah, I hope what you're saying is right. I hope it's an icebreaker or, you know, ceiling breaker. Hopefully many more women and men actually will follow us, because now calcification field is very, very active. Maybe 4, 5, 7 years ago, there were no NIH grants on calcification, but now almost every study section has calcification grants. So I think it tells a lot.
That's very, very interesting. Now, you're a medical doctor.
I'm a pathologist by training, yes.
Okay, so why did you decide to go into the research end of things?
Good question. So I graduated first medical school. Then right after that, I went to Institute of Biophysics and did my PhD in pathology. And right after that, I came here to Boston in 1990. And then because of some family issues, I didn't take medical board in US as well. I had two kids. I needed to take care of them, so it wasn't so easy. But I decided that I will do research, and I can see things which other people don't see because of my pathology eyes, and you know, pathological eyes.
Well, it's interesting because the discoverer of matrix vesicles that calcify that you're studying, Clark Anderson, was also a pathologist.
I mean, we look at the tissue and we see many things which other people don't see. That's very interesting. I looked at the microscope with many of my colleagues, and they always surprised how many stories I can make from one slide. You know, in fact, I had one of the investigators just last week, and I spent whole week with her looking at the microscope because they wanted my interpretation of their data, and it was quite interesting.
So that's how it all started. And now we're going to hear about the significance of Aikawa's work for all of us. It's about the tiny calcifications that form in our arteries and eventually turn them to stone. It begins when the thin lining of the inside of your arteries, known as the endothelium, is damaged. This injury is caused by everything from infection to toxic metals to poor nutrition. It's this first trigger that sets off the hardening process known as calcification or hardening of the arteries.
Why are you getting this response that eventually leads to calcification? You have the injury, and then what happens?
So basically, once you have the endothelial injury, endothelium start to signal outside and say, I'm injured, heal me. So the cells in the blood, so-called monocytes, they will be attracted to endothelium very naturally because it's signaling them to do something. And once they find the gap between endothelial cells, it will go inside. And then these monocytes become activated and they grow into the large macrophages, because macrophages will start to eat everything around them.
Is that cleaning up the damage?
It's cleaning up the damage, exactly. Okay. And they start to balloon, but at the same time, they release lots of other substances which can signal in surrounding cells. For example, smooth muscle cells, and smooth muscle cells start to become pathological cells. Instead of producing healthy collagen, they start to produce calcium. And then this is how microcalcification forms. So when you have microcalcification in the plaque, which is very rich in fat and soft tissue, and then when you have this microcalcification, which are very strong and solid, those microcalcification create very strong mechanical stresses around the poles of those microcalcification. And if this microcalcification locates in a thin fibrous cap of the atherosclerotic lesion, it will rupture the plaque. So this is a danger of microcalcification.
It's strange, isn't it? Because so many people hear from their doctors, for example, well, the calcification is actually stabilizing your arteries, but actually these microcalcifications, I hear you saying, do something quite different.
They do something different, that's true. So there are two types of calcification, as you mentioned, the microcalcification, which are dangerous or harmful calcification, and also larger calcification, potentially stabilize the plaque. So many computational scientists don't believe that they stabilize the plaque. And the reason is still those microcalcification located or localized within the very soft tissue. So there is still stress concentrations around those areas, and plaque rupture could occur, for example, in patients with high blood pressure. But, you know, the microcalcification particularly dangerous because we don't see them by a clinical imaging modalities. So we even don't know that patients have them because we're not able to visualize them. So how does it work? So there are two levels of how microcalcifications form. The first one, let's say more simple one, when microcalcification form outside the cell, where we showed that cells release those calcification-prone extracellular vesicles. And then those vesicles aggregate with each other. So microcalcification, let's say if it's 15 microns, would have probably hundreds of vesicles within it. which emerge with each other. Then those microcalcification will also coalesce with each other and form larger and larger calcification, and that's how it processed grow. But on the other hand, there is a intracellular machinery which make those vesicles. So vesicles, as I mentioned, form in the cells all the time for different reasons, and they do different things. But calcifying vesicles are very specific. Calcifying vesicles start with so-called sertilin. So sertilin is transporter molecule. It transports other particles or molecules within the cell. And for the first time, we demonstrated that sertilin also plays an important role in formation of calcifying vesicles. So it was new biology of sertilin. That's why this paper was published in very high impact journal. So sertilin, let's say, get activated by certain molecules which are present within the cell. And then this activated sertilin takes another molecule which is already sitting there and being activated. Sertilin will bind to this activated alkaline phosphatase, which is essential molecule for calcification. And you find it in all calcifying organs, and you find it in the bone as well. So it will grab this and bring it to recycling endosome. Recycling endosome is another vesicle within the cell, which will surface container, and then this molecule will be moved to the membrane of the cell. So the vesicle would be released now outside of the cells, and this vesicle will contain this active alkaline phosphatase, which is key to calcify the vesicle. That's how calcification-prone vesicle formed. And then it will aggregate with other vesicles, become microcalcification. That's a process in our understanding.
So it's a little bit like a factory doing quite a complicated chemical manufacturing in various vats. And then at the end, the assembly takes place. Yes. And then they deliver it to the FedEx station. And the FedEx station actually delivers it to the rest of the world. Is that an accurate description?
You got it.
So just by the virtue of the tremendous complexity that you've so nicely encapsulated there, no pun intended, it's really an amazing process. Now, the vesicle itself, what is it made up of?
Good question. So I always consider vesicle as a little tiny cell without nucleus. So it contains everything which cell contains. It has lipids, it has microRNAs, it has cytoplasm of the cells, but it doesn't have nucleus. So it cannot repopulate, but it can do many other things, bad and good.
What's on the exterior of the vesicle?
Exterior of the vesicles is a lipid membrane, exactly the same membrane what cell has. So that is very important to understand, because this is how vesicles interact with the cells and interact with each other. It's funny to say that vesicles are very, very busy structures. So you and me are talking now, right? And we're sitting, we're practically doing nothing, just open our mouth. And at the same time, all our cells releasing those vesicles. And vesicles are getting busy and interact with each other and interact with the other cells. In non-disease condition, vesicles just serve as a messengers. But in disease condition, when, for example, patient has atherosclerosis or chronic kidney disease or diabetes, vesicles also become pathological. So they could be good guys and they could be bad guys. And in these pathological conditions, they get these structures what cell in this pathological condition would have. So this is what we're looking. We're looking for the proteins which are different between calcifying and not calcifying condition. And we find the proteins which potentially were changed in disease condition, in calcifying condition. And these top 10 proteins would be our candidates to make, based on their structure, make inhibitors to inhibit calcification.
So it sounds like you're saying there's basically a constant battle going on between the proteins that prevent calcification and the proteins that cause calcification. Is that correct?
Exactly. So basically what you do, what you have after your screening, you have a bunch of, let's say, 3,000 proteins. Some of them are increased in calcifying conditions. Some of them decreased in calcifying conditions. So let's say first I would be interested in one which are increased in calcifying condition, because this, it's easy for me to inhibit them by make inhibitor to those proteins.
So what would happen would be that, for example, you'd identify a group of proteins that prevent this calcification, and theoretically you could then administer this as a drug to prevent the development. Do you think it's possible to also use them to reverse calcification?
Yeah, absolutely. Drug discovery and drug development are very, very difficult and lengthy processes, and also time-consuming, money-consuming, everything-consuming. But our task in the center where I work is to identify the targets. So the targets we identify in different kind of situation, in diabetic condition, atherosclerotic condition, the chronic kidney disease, you know, we then look for those top candidates which we think are druggable, and then we will send the numbers of those candidates to Tokyo company which we're working with, and they are doing drug development, which is very different from what we're doing. So we discover things, they develop drug using our discoveries. We recently published our first target, which we discovered in our lab. We found one single protein out of the 3,500 something proteins. And we demonstrated that we could inhibit this protein using computational analysis. We screened several molecules from existing drugs, which could inhibit our molecule, which we discovered. And we hope that this old drug, which already FDA approved and, you know, used for probably more than 20 years in the treatment for certain diseases, this particular drug or small molecule can inhibit calcification. It's very interesting. Two papers published like within 1 year from each other, one which is target discovery and another one is finding the treatment to inhibit calcification through that mechanism.
So the reason that that drug was never used against heart disease before is because they didn't know that.
They had no idea. It's anti-helminthic drug. Who knew?
There's a lot of this going on where people identify new uses for old drugs. How do you modify that approach so that the drug has therapeutic effect on inhibiting the calcification? Is there anything that you have to do, change the delivery mode or what?
You still need to have phase 1, 2, 3 clinical trials against calcification. It's not so simple. It's not like you take the drug and you just apply it for different condition. No, I think it's different. However, it has very low toxicity, practically no toxicity.
The other advantage that you have is that you're already working with a pharmaceuticals company that is familiar with how to repurpose drugs.
Yeah, so they will do it. That's their role. That's their role. And that's how we separate our activities. We do discovery, they do development of the drugs. So once we discover, now we have this small molecule, we send it to them and they work with that.
Well, congratulations. That could end up being extremely significant.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. At least it could be probably one, the first drug which can treat calcification in humans.
To learn more about Elena Aikawa's work and to get updates, log on to www.natureoflongevity.com. That's natureoflongevity, all one word, .com. That's all for this edition of The Nature of Longevity. I'm your host, Douglas Mulhall. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.